Hi everyone! In 2024, I hope you're ready to discover more inspiring stories of powerful women in the multifamily industry. I'm Laura Kalugar, Senior Editor with Multihousing News, and you're listening to Mission Success, Women in Multifamily, the monthly podcast series dedicated to remarkable female leaders in the apartment business. We're starting the year strong by talking to the CEO of one of the oldest and largest operators in the United States, Village Green. The company turned 100 in 2019, and Diane Bataille has been a devoted team member for the past 40 years. She started as part-time sales consultant and worked her way up to the top. Hi, Diane. Thank you so much for accepting my invitation.
Hello, Laura. It's absolutely my pleasure. I look forward to it.
So I've read a lot about your multifamily journey, and wow, it's impressive to hear that someone has been loyal to the same company for more than four decades. Another fantastic thing about your career is that you worked your way up from part-time leasing agent to CEO, which is, again, not that common. So my question here is, how has the multifamily industry changed throughout the past 40 years? How much have your views changed since you started off in the industry?
Well, given that I started as a baby, you know, long before child labor laws were enacted, I would say I've matured quite a bit in the last 40 years. It's interesting. Village Green is a company that's been around for more than 100 years. It was founded in 1919. And so it has seen a lot of changes. And when I began 43 years ago, it was operated by the family who founded it. It was actually the second generation founding fathers of the company. They were immigrants, actually, the founding fathers who came over from Russia and to the land of opportunity. And so with them, they brought a lot of the cultural and sort of economic environment that they had been accustomed to and then adapted and assimilated in the U.S. So the influence of the markets, the economy, and the type of diverse company that we were on the onset has continued. I would say that's the one thing that hasn't changed, is that we've maintained that, I would say, perspective on how, you know, the environment kind of affects the business and the need to continuously evolve and also be cognizant of just how wonderful it is, you know, to have a business in the United States as compared to what maybe other countries experience. Mm-hmm. So when I came in with the second generation, we were an owner operator. Village Green managed, created, developed multifamily along with commercial. And my journey began on the multifamily management side of the business. At that point in time, the economy was robust and things were going well. We had products that were geared toward affordable all the way through, I would call, luxury class A assets. And so I've got, you know, I had the perspective of a lot of different demographic profiles and understanding, you know, how those preferences have changed over time. So having that perspective on the markets, the demographic that will live in these particular apartment units taught me, you know, what my perspective should be. So for example, I've seen probably three recessions, and how has that influenced the multifamily industry over time? The very first that I experienced, everybody needs a roof over their head. So we absolutely saw strength in that marketplace when people could not afford to buy homes. You know, inflation was an issue at that point in time. They needed a roof over their head. So the apartment industry remained strong, although maybe you couldn't push rents as much. So we had to be sensitive to the delta on lease trade out rates. That's one example. How has it changed today as compared to 40 years ago? I would tell you that the focus on the people that are operating, the residents that are living in the communities, is greater today than it was 40 plus years ago. I think it was much more perceived as a commodity marketplace. Today, I think there are greater choices. There are, again, a vaster array of profiles that are renting in apartments. You have more renters by choice as compared to that point in time. And it's become a much more sophisticated industry from the standpoint of technology and so on. I could go on and on, Laura. There are so many different, you know, areas and tentacles that I've seen changes. So if you have specific focus you'd like me to concentrate on, I'm happy to do it. But I'll summarize by saying the different roles I've had at the company on both the capital markets and investment side and the operations side have given me a lot different perspective, along with the economic times and influences and consumer trends. And again, the focus on people and culture.
One thing I'd like to ask you to expand on is how people's lifestyle preferences have changed over the years, because being in the industry for so long must help you a lot today when it comes to understanding what your residents need or what they want.
Yes, absolutely. I'll tell you, we have to look at it from the standpoint of the demographic profile of that particular renter market. We operate properties across the United States in 20 different states and various markets, Northeast, Southeast, Midwest, and Southwest. And then also, given the product type, it could be first-time renters just leaving college and forming their own households, all the way through empty nesters that are lifestyle by choice, kind of moving away from a single family home. So if you start with the market, is it an urban location? Is it a suburban location? And then what is that age group? If we look at the younger demographic in urban core markets, today they tend to be much more concerned about technology and connectivity as opposed to back in, you know, decades ago when that particular profile was more focused on forming their new homes. They were more social outside their apartment homes versus how they are today. And I think the pandemic's had something to do with that.
Yeah, we'll touch on that immediately. Yep. Mm-hmm.
So they are absolutely looking for what I just mentioned. And then, of course, the social engagement opportunities are bigger today than they once were, having more communal spaces, the ability to get together and socialize. Whereas the other end of that spectrum, I like to call it the barbell of demand, where you've got on the one hand, the younger renters, and on the other extreme, the empty nester market. The middle, really, those are more, I would say, single family home purchasers and second or third time renters that are just parked in an apartment while they can afford to move out and buy. Mm-hmm. So on the other end of that spectrum, what we're seeing be most important to them is space in their apartments, higher end finishes, and social activities, but from a different perspective. You know, the types of things they'll want to do is very different from the types of things that the younger demographic profile want to do. We tend to see higher staffing levels in the, let's call it the senior market rate market, where we do have to have more staffing per resident to accommodate a higher need for service and social activities as compared to the younger demographic that, you know, many times they want to do everything digitally or automated. Those are their preferences versus those human touch points that we tend to see more in demand at the older demographic profile.
Let's focus on the past years for a bit, because we've gone through unique challenges and experiences, mainly fueled by the pandemic. And you mentioned this a couple of minutes ago. The health crisis is pretty much behind us, but its effects are still present. How have you perceived these past few years? What effects have these past 5 years had on multifamily developers?
You know, I like to call it the now normal, Laura, because we saw some changes occur that were sparked by the pandemic that were more or less required and forced upon developers and operators, that then morphed into a preference that residents now have, that you then had to broaden your spectrum of services and what you'd offer. So as an example, when we were on lockdown, everybody in the multifamily industry had to get creative in how to conduct and maintain business continuity. So renting was a big one, where we saw a pivot to automated options and virtual options. Mm-hmm. And now that's become more or less a now normal, where you give that as an option And what mm-hmm. I will say is you cannot take away the human touch points. That's also necessary and required to retain residents. And also many prefer to have those human interactions as right. they're on the front end and then when they're being serviced and so forth. So we've expanded the, let's call it the menu of opportunities on how people can rent an apartment, have their apartment serviced and so on. So that's here to stay. And that I think is a positive, which was triggered, you know, by that pandemic. The vulnerability is another thing that I'll talk about, you know, common spaces and how we used to program those. We didn't have to worry so much about distance between machines and exercise facilities, as an example, or having potentially scheduling when someone wants to use a space and not go beyond a certain, you know, body count within spaces that might be more confined. Those are a couple of examples of things that have changed in terms of how we program properties, how we operate properties, and even sanitation stations to some degree have stuck. So that, you know, recognition of our vulnerability as humans and, you know, the risks associated with that have gone from, I would call it, high level of concern and fear to now, this is how we're integrating our normal in environments where we're going to interact with the public and be cognizant of what those sensitivities and make it easy and make it comfortable, but also make it continue to feel like home.
And I think that's here to stay, right?
So yes, we're absolutely. I agree. We were on the verge of rolling out, I would say, more technologies and automated ways of doing business and getting efficient when it comes to operations. What I think happened with the pandemic, it's accelerated that. And so many companies that were beta testing things or sitting on the sidelines waiting to see what would occur, they were sort of forced into the deep end of the pool. Right. And I think to some extent, it was a little bit of a slow learning process of doing things wrong and correcting than we would have otherwise done. So on the other side of that, I think it's all been positive. I would say one thing to be cautious of, there are many startups that are constantly pitching their wares, if you will. And I think mm-hmm. as owners and operators, we have to be very diligent in due diligence and not rush ourselves into doing something that maybe is a little premature. So I would say that that's something to be cautious of.
Speaking of cautious, the economic environment is quite challenging, and many developers are being cautious today. Yes. Everyone's affected by high interest rates, supply chain disruptions, the lack of skilled labor, and so on. But you've been through similar periods, right? Over the past four decades, there were multiple downturns, as you said at the beginning of our conversation. Is there mm-hmm. anything developers today can learn from past downturns, from previous downturns?
Yes. When we were an owner-operator, I would say from 1919 through 2017, and I did have that hat on. I had evolved along with the company and observed those evolutions. In my role as developer and chief investment officer, ultimately, I did see quite a bit of learning from those economic downturns. And then now in a seat that's overseeing purely operations and related services and operations, we can then consult those owners and those developers mm-hmm. having that perspective. So with that as a backdrop, what I'll say is what we learned in those downturns was the focus on efficiencies and operating expense savings and the recognition that there will be obstacles to new development and construction. So the lease-ups that we're doing today that are feeling the brunt of, I would say, the most recent economic downturn, we've seen stalling of progress on those developments. We absolutely have seen supply chain constraints. And so how we navigate through that, definitely I'm tapping past experience on that. So what we do as operators is that focus on efficiencies, figuring out ways to help that developer save money and then manage expectations of prospects and renters that have to be patient as we get through maybe a longer lease up period, a longer construction period. Fixed costs have absolutely been hit hard. Insurance, I think that everybody who's listening probably will know what I'm referring to when I say it's the worst I've ever seen it. I would say it's double digit increases year over year on property and liability insurance. And many of the insurance companies that were in the market are now out of the market. So there are fewer options. And so that's obviously driven up costs. Real estate taxes, utilities, those things we cannot control. So the focus on what we can control, as an example, operating software, making sure that that's single stack and as efficient as possible and can do what we need to do with potentially fewer bodies. Although I would never steer away from going full automation. I mentioned that earlier, those human touch points are extremely important. So we're looking at what can we centralize? What can we do cheaper and more efficiently? Operating software is one example of that. The other is unit turnovers. How can we do that more efficiently? MRO costs. And so having relationships with supplier partners nationally, leveraging scale and critical mass that we have, we're close to 50,000 units today. So having that scale is absolutely beneficial when we bring that buying power to the table. So those are a few examples of how we can help an owner get efficient, reduce cost on controllable expenses, understanding that we're going to be very limited on how hard we can push rent and how quickly we can lease something up.
Mm-hmm. One major impact of COVID on the multifamily industry is that transition from downtown development to suburban development. Mm-hmm. What's your take on this trend? Is it temporary? Will it reverse once more people return to their office full time? Or are work from home patterns here to stay?
I think it depends on market and it depends on the demographic profile of the renter. Those are the two key ingredients, I would say, that you've got to consider in answering that question. So I'll take Chicago as an example, which is one of our core markets. We have urban and we have suburban. So during the pandemic, we saw a flight from the city and higher occupancy in suburban properties with double-digit rent increases for a solid 2 years. And in the urban core, obviously, as offices shut down and businesses failed, that absolutely impacted multifamily. What we're seeing today is a return. I would say they're probably 60-ish percent back. Mm-hmm. And we've seen a correlating increase in occupancy and in rental rates. But it's still slow. In Chicago, there are so many reasons to be in the urban core. Entertainment, and I do see jobs coming back and more development in the pipeline. So I think that's a matter of time, Laura. Then I'll look at the suburban markets where they are. Those are much more impacted by what's going on in the single family markets. And so when mm-hmm. you see interest rates climb and people unable to go from rental to single family purchasing, we see the benefit of that in multifamily apartments in suburban markets, which is what's occurred. That and a new product, relatively new, which is the build for rent product, single family, rentals. Subdivisions. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So that is a new area of the business that I see getting a lot of traction now. So that's also helping to shore up suburban markets and the rental, let's say housing stock, as well as demand and the supply for that demand. In markets like Minneapolis, let's take that as another example of, I would say, a little bit of a nuance. That's taking much longer to recover. And why that is because the employment base is significantly shifting in a way that I think I'd put in a classification of maybe more permanent than other markets where we see the core employers not abandoning ship, if you will. We've mm-hmm. seen downtown Minneapolis be greatly impacted by the Target move. And so that to me, core CBD Minneapolis it's going to take a while before they can replace that. So I think that is an example of a market that could be, let's call it semi-permanent, until that employment base gets shored up again. We also are seeing, you know, the areas like Lake Calhoun and Uptown higher, leasing up quicker and higher rent. So what CBD may have lost, those who still want that urban feel and proximity to the urban locations are choosing those sorts of first ring markets, we'll call. So again, I could go on. There are so many markets that we're in today where we're seeing different.
Yeah, but these examples are very good.
Yeah, it's a good example of what we're experiencing elsewhere to lesser or greater degrees.
Going back to residents' lifestyles, we must touch on pets and the fact that many people have furry friends in their lives. Pet ownership has skyrocketed during the past few decades. So these pets are not only influencing housing decisions, but also community choices. To what extent does Village Green take into consideration this preference when expanding to new areas?
We're not developers, but we do consult developers today. And so that is a big question for us when we're talking about programming and then when we're opining on plans and specs. Pets today are viewed as family more than ever before. And so you absolutely have to consider them. I don't know of a community where you, where I see owners and developers even considering not allowing pets. There may be restrictions around it, sort of breed restrictions, as an example, and control and fees and things of that nature. But having them in a community is important. So what we're, what we've seen is more demand for programs around animals, offerings like benefits at the community, something that might not have been considered before. We have renter's insurance, and now pet insurance becomes an option. As an example, right? So when a prospect walks into an office, it's not unusual to see a pet station where, you know, there's water and there are treats for the pet in the leasing office. So that, along with community amenities like pet parks, which are called bark parks in some of our communities, and making sure that those are well cared for, even in urban environments, we have to think about and advise developers and construction companies on the best way to handle that. Areas outside, and when they have to be inside, they need to be well ventilated. Cleanliness is extremely important. Sanitation is very important. And so those are things that we're always looking at and advising on. So inside pet spas is another example of things that we're seeing more of in communities as they're being developed.
Please tell us more about demand for outdoor space, parks, green spaces, because this is another effect of the pandemic that seems to to stay.
Absolutely. Many developers, ourselves included at the time, even in urban locations, considered this important. A renter, like any other, you know, person living in a home, they need the ability not only to feel a sanctuary within their, within the confines of the four walls in their home, but also having a place to go outside where they can also feel that comfort. And so, as an example, in urban cores, a rooftop deck is more common today than it ever has been. It may or may not have a pool, but the ability to go outside and enjoy the fresh air and commune with nature is very, very important. So I would say in an urban location, it's more important than suburban to get creative and figure out a way to give that to that prospect. The difference in urban is that, you know, there are more pedestrian lifestyle renters living in those locations. And so for them to be able to walk out their door, walk around town, absolutely, that's true and that's important. But they also want a place, whether it's an interior courtyard, a rooftop deck, as I mentioned, someplace where they can, again, be outdoors. And I think the pandemic made that even more important to think about and consider in development. Suburban locations, the choice of location is what we see more often than not. The school system, proximity to parks, and outdoor green spaces is important, and developers should be considering that when they select a parcel and they go through the zoning and the site plan approval. How do we marry up the community and provide things on site that are, I would say, complementary to the area? Mm-hmm. And those areas are very important, especially with young families that want to park nearby to take their child to.
Another aspect that's very important for both developers and operators is the fact that the U.S. population is getting older and older. And there are lots of stats that say that by 2040, about 1 in 5 Americans will be age 65 or older, which is up from 1 in 8 in the 2000s. How do these stats impact your decisions? How does an aging population impact multifamily operations?
I would say there's two sides of the demographic shifting in the US. And that's one. If you look at it as a barbell, as I mentioned earlier, that's one side of the barbell. The other side are the younger groups that are forming new households. And that's a large segment of the population as well. And many times, you know, you can marry those two up in one community. But when we think about that older demographic, they also have a higher net worth than they did decades ago. So they're more discriminating. And I'm referring to market rate communities as opposed to affordable communities, which are very different in terms of preferences and expectations. So the communities that we operate are on that side of the spectrum where they do have those higher expectations and preferences. And so they're willing to pay more rent, meaning you can then afford to provide those higher services. We definitely see a ratio between staffing levels at those communities being higher than they are at other communities with the younger demographic profile. I mentioned earlier, Laura, so I don't want to be redundant about that particular trend and what we do and why we need those. And so again, I think interior spaces as they're being developed, larger units are important. And I don't mean more bedrooms. I think it's really more space within the rooms. That profile tends to bring some of their furnishings, which tend to be large from the homes that they've just closed up, and they are quote unquote downsizing, but they still want to have their own dining rooms to host Thanksgivings as an example for their families.
Family gatherings. Yeah.
Yes. I'll tell you a funny story. We managed a property where a matriarch of the family didn't have enough room in her unit. So she essentially closed down the common area hallway, set up a table, and hosted Thanksgiving. And I'm like, okay, that's a light bulb moment. We need to give advice to make those dining rooms larger. This is very funny. And they're willing to customize their units more. They'll come in and look at our basic unit and then say, well, I want marble countertops, or I want, can I take this wall down and create a larger bedroom and eliminate a bedroom? So you have to make choices on what is going to add value to the community that you should absolutely support, let them spend their money on it, that you can then re-rent down the road for a higher value. And then what is something that you can't do because it would reduce value. So that ROI needs to be there, even though they're the ones writing the check. They also tend to be in the apartments longer. So turnover is lower, which is a benefit, you know, on the operating expense side. On the other hand, the higher expectations and demand equates to quicker service turnaround time, potentially higher staffing levels in order to make sure, you know, we're taking care of them in, you know, as quick as amount of time as possible.
Is there any way you can anticipate these needs and how they're changing it quickly? I don't know, evolving? Yes. Is it hard to adapt to these evolving lifestyle preferences as an owner operator?
Here's what I love that I've learned in my 4 decades. The more things change, the more they stay the same. It's so true. And so while the products available, the technologies available might change and get better, the core needs and wants don't generally change. And what I find to be the most useful for any developer and owner is to listen to those people that are interacting with the prospects and the residents. So that mm-hmm. would be the leasing staff, the service team, the property manager. I always recommend that any developer have a focus group as they're going through and developing their plans, sitting down with the marketing and salespeople and asking, what does the market want today in terms of finishes, spaces, amenities, all those sorts of things. So that's how you stay ahead of it. If you can sit down and talk to people that are interacting with that profile of resident, whatever it might be, every single day, and can talk to you about real-time feedback and avoid the pitfall of some developers feeling as though what I want is what my market's going to want. The other idea would be you can hire a market research group, but I find more value in focus groups. And when you've decided where you're going to develop and who that target market is, bringing together people of that same demographic makeup and then mm-hmm. asking for feedback. So I think keep your eyes and ears open. You can certainly read everybody else's opinion, but there's no substitute for the people that you're actually going to be renting to and the people that are serving them.
Right. Because we're nearing the end of our conversation, I have a question that I ask all of my guests, and it's a different aspect of the industry. How has diversity and inclusion in the industry evolved over the years? Is there more emphasis on supporting women of all backgrounds access leadership roles today than it was two or three decades ago?
That's an absolute yes. And having been around and seen the shift, personally experiencing that, when I started, I was a wet behind the ears, still in college, young, you know, woman, from a background that had a very strong tradition in, you know, the males kind of running the household, being the main mm-hmm. breadwinner. And so coming from that background and entering this industry back in those days, it was not a profession, Laura. It was something you did on your way to either finding, you know, your profession that you're going to do for the rest of your career, or, you know, parking until you're, you know, you become married and then, you know, your husband is supporting the
family.
Was
going to provide, yeah.
That's absolutely how it was. And so people fell into the industry. I was fortunate that I was given opportunities and had great mentorship to get outside my comfort zone and undertake opportunities I would otherwise have had. At that time, very early in my career, women were groomed to be on site. You know, maybe you got as far as a property manager, but that's the extent of it. So any
that was
of the regional, mm-hmm. that was it. There was absolutely a glass ceiling, whether it was conscious or unconscious. And then there was unconscious bias as it relates not just to females, but to minorities in general. So it was a homogenous group within the multifamily industry at the mid-manager and above level. And then, of course, on the construction side, on the development side, capital markets side, it was absolutely unusual, let's say at best, to have females in those roles. So I've seen, you know, that change to now where we are. It's much more diverse. There's much more equity and there's much more awareness. At Village Green, given that it started with, you know, immigrants, the company has always been diverse, I would say, over the 100 years we've been in existence. So if you looked around, you would see plenty of diversity at different levels of the company. However, at the executive level, again, it was not as diverse as it is today. What also didn't exist was, I would say, inclusion. You can have diversity, but not be inclusive. So there's unconscious bias that exists in companies, even today, that are mm-hmm. professing to be diverse. And so I think having that focus on how can we be inclusive? One of the things we started at Village Green, and many companies started later, was we always had a diversity, equity, and inclusion committee comprised of people from the field and sponsored by one of our directors in human resources, which we call people services. And so we always had our finger on the pulse of what was going on in the field and what maybe our practices and policies and procedures weren't tuned in to how it might have made people feel excluded. So we've continued to kind of stay concentrated on that. And I always advise my colleagues who ask me, you know, how has Village Green been so successful at having, you know, diversity at every level of the organization? And then we're taking it one step further. We rolled out what we call Focus on the Field. And I host lunches with different verticals of the organization on site. So it could be one month is with people that are in leasing. The other might be service. I go along with the person that runs all of our people services. And we just talk to them. We take them lunch. What are we doing right? What can we be doing better? So again, asking people that are impacted by your policies is the greatest form of knowledge and feedback and having the ability to pivot when you're doing something unintentionally. So I would say that's really, really important to understand. You can never rest. It's an ongoing fluid situation, and being sensitive to that and aware of that is critical to continuing on the right trajectory of equity for all, which is the most important thing.
Right. I agree. Diane, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. It was really a pleasure talking to you.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me, Laura. I truly enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you all for listening. The next Mission Success episode will come out on the third week of February. But until then, you can check multihousingnews.com for the latest news, feature stories, and podcasts. And if you want to share your own voice with our audience, the MHN Executive Council is your go-to platform. This online tool is dedicated to multifamily leaders who want to stay in touch with each other and discuss trends and issues affecting the industry. All their valuable insights are regularly posted on our website. So if you're interested in having your voice heard, please get in touch with Editor-in-Chief Jessica Fuhrer at jessica.fuhrer@cpe-mhn.com. Till next month.